from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The temptation for modern Americans to oversimplify their conceptions of bygone times is hard to resist, but especially so in the instance of the Middle Ages, the period in European history that extends from about 500 AD to around the year 1500, embracing an enormous amount of cultural, social, and political history. For example, why do modern audiences think of this period in England as the Dark Ages? What are some of the differences and parallels that characterize the contract social systems we now inhabit in comparison and contrast to the status societies of the Middle Ages? The panelists for the following Soundings discussion are four professors of medieval English: David Benson, Judson Allen, Judith Furster, and Mary Tavormina. David Benson teaches at the University of Connecticut, Judson Allen at the University of Florida, Judith Furster at Brandeis University, and Mary Tavormina at Michigan State University. David Benson, Judith Furster, and Mary Tavormina have all completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. The discussion begins with comments by David Benson.
Well, I'm not sure about the idea of the Dark Ages, but it seems to me the thing that always irritates me when people talk about the Middle Ages is calling it an age of faith.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me that's our perspective of what the Middle Ages are, that from the Middle Ages point of view, they were not an age of faith, they were an age of reason. They thought that they knew how the world worked. They thought they knew how the world worked better than anybody has since.
Well, what about this whole thing about the dominance of religion or the Catholic Church? Isn't there some truth to that, Judson?
Well, there's some truth to it, but it's like the fish in the sea, not conscious of the water they swim in.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to talk about everything we talk about in scientific terms. They tended to talk about everything they talked about in Christian terms. But they sinned just as gloriously and flagrantly as we do.
Mm-hmm. Judith Furster?
There was also a tremendous conflict within the church about what was a matter of faith, what was a matter of reason. And what the modern stereotypes and cliches don't say is the amount of struggle, intellectual struggle, that was going on over just what faith covered and what it didn't.
Well, let's come back to some of these stereotypes. Were the Middle Ages, were they more moral? Were they somehow or other better people because of the influence, however pervasive, of religion? David?
Well, I think the question of what you mean by better is the problem here. I think the great difference, perhaps, that the Middle Ages had from our age is that I think they believed their world made sense. And this goes back to the idea of it's not right to call them an age of faith. It seems to me, I don't think they had faith in the tenets of the church. I think they knew that the tenets of the church were true. And I think they thought that the world did make sense. And while there were individual sins, I mean, people committed lust and adultery and envy and greed, and a lot of medieval literature deals with that, I think they thought that those lusts and envies meant something. They meant something. They needed to confess them because they had a significance.
By contrast with what?
With, I think, the modern world, or I think the great question in the modern world is whether any of it makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Whether if you don't get on television, are you real?
Judith?
The difference that people often point to as making the difference between the Middle Ages and us is science. And they want to point to some watershed, sometimes in the Renaissance, sometimes later, which created modern science, thus giving us the benefits of penicillin and the atom bomb. The trouble with that is that it ignores the basis laid for empirical science in the Middle Ages, so that Galileo, for instance, doesn't just come suddenly inventing a new idea which sheds all these clouds of superstition, but rather is a development out of centuries worth of work that that produces and makes way for modern science.
Tell me about medieval alchemy, for instance. Is it, on the one hand, it implies science, but on the other hand, it implies a mysteriousness. And is there anything to be said for or against science, as we know it, in the Middle Ages, Tess?
Let me pick up on, not on the alchemy, but on what Judith Furster was saying about the Middle Ages laying a groundwork for science. There's a way in which science... very much depends, there's a faith in science that the universe is rational, that the laws of physics, say Newton's laws, are going to be the same today as they were yesterday. And that, in many ways, is grounded in the medieval faith that since man is rational, man is the image of God, therefore God must be rational, therefore the universe must be rational. In that sense, I think that the age of faith and age of reason distinction that, that David Benson made earlier tells us something about where our own modern age comes from and how it is indeed grounded in that, that medieval notion of the world.
Mm-hmm. Judith?
The other thing you need for science is a sense of the particular. You need that sense of structure in the universe, and you also need the sense that what is knowable is individual things, particulars, details. And in order to get that, you need Aristotle, who was rediscovered in the 13th century and very important for the future development of science.
Judson?
It seems to me that one of the great themes of medieval argument is precisely this question of the particular. What is a particular? What is an individual? And medieval people were very nervous about the possibility that there might be particulars that don't have names, that do not connect to some definition, to some universal, to some role. There might be particulars, as it were, loose in the world that don't connect.
In other words, this is why they would like to make lists of behaviors and sins and retributions and punishments and things like that.
And it's very interesting. When medieval people make a list of the seven sins, what they intend by this is that this list will be a sufficient list and a complete list. It will cover everything. The possibility of sin divides into seven, exactly seven, and only seven.
Well, what's the impulse for this? Is it religion, or is it just human psychology, the desire to sort of envelop the world and understand it in some fashion?
It's a desire to see the world under the rubric of completeness.
Mm-hmm. David?
And I think it's the belief, again, that the world could be seen this way, that this faith. I mean, you certainly find this in the in what's called the High Middle Ages, the 13th century, where people thought that they could make encyclopedias about theological questions, about the natural world, that would include everything. By the end of this period, this faith seems to be waning, and people no longer seem to have the ability. And in this way, perhaps the High Middle Ages are, in a sense, like the 19th century, which also seems to have had that, the great age of encyclopedias and dictionaries, believe that they could get a grasp on all that was knowable. Well, perhaps the most obvious point to be made is that our university system comes from the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of the greatest debts we have to the Middle Ages, and again, it starts in the in this high medieval period, or perhaps at the end of the high medieval period, where people believe they can get a grasp on all kinds of knowledge.
Tess?
In a lot of ways, the medieval university system, at least, the system of education through the church, brought a lot of people in who would not have come in to positions of power otherwise. People who were from much lower than aristocratic backgrounds could, if they were bright and lucky, it certainly was not a tremendous number of people, but still could rise in the church and, in fact, become cardinals and occasionally even popes. More likely, they would remain at a level of local power, becoming, say, a parish priest or working in the bishop's court, but that still was a tremendous advance over, say, the background, perhaps a villain background even, a peasant background that they might have come from. And the church did allow for that, and that was really one of the few ways of fast mobility in the Middle Ages.
Judson, you had a comment.
In the Middle Ages, you can't always get agreement, but you can at least get agreement on how to proceed when you're arguing what is good and what is bad.
In other words, there were social ground rules, as it were.
Logical ground rules.
Uh-huh.
Whereas now it is philosophically impossible to make the statement that is good. I mean, anything more powerful than I like that.
Mm-hmm. Judith?
We were talking about diversity versus unity. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the late Middle Ages, where I think you have less of that sense of agreement and more of that sense that different people like different things. I think of Chaucer, who repeats the line several times in the Canterbury Tales, divers folk, diversely thy han sida. Different people said different things when they saw wonders or heard tales. And some of that, I think Chaucer was aware, had to do with self-interest and desire and I like that because I am who I am.
Do we have anything today that corresponds to the Canterbury Tales in terms of the intentions of the author or the audience to which the work would be addressed or the social effects of the Canterbury Tales? Are they unique to the Middle Ages? David?
I have a very minor and somewhat silly example, but it seems to me that in understanding Chaucer, as far as we know, read his works aloud before an audience. There's some, in the manuscripts, he sometimes talks about his works as being read silently, and he obviously understands that will be done, but he also addresses an audience and talks about a listening audience. And it seems to me that that fact of oral presentation is a very... again, one of the things is very different from modern presentation. Perhaps the closest thing to it in the modern world, to answer your question, is a stand-up comedian. That a stand-up comedian, in a way, has to... most writers today do not know precisely how their individual scenes work. If a scene is supposed to make someone cry and 99 out of 100 readers, when they read it, actually giggle, that writer will not probably know that. He may get a sense of it from reviews. A stand-up comedian, however, if he tells a joke and nobody laughs, he has an immediate and embarrassing knowledge of that, and that joke will not be told the same way the next time. So I think one of the things that you find in Chaucer, and I think it's true with a lot of medieval writers, and one of the things that makes them so delightful to read is their willingness to please and their desire to please. And I think a lot of this comes from a much closer connection with the audience than high art has in our time.
It's ironic that you would compare the Canterbury Tales to the work of a stand-up comedian, and yet we in the 20th century look back on it and think of the Canterbury Tales as high art, as a canonical sort of cultural resource. Judson?
But we also think of Charlie Chaplin as high art.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about Geoffrey Chaucer, The Canterbury Tales, The Middle Ages. Let me ask you to comment as specifically as you can. What was life like, Judson?
Life was continually being on stage. Life was a play. Life was a series of ceremonies. Life was people presenting themselves to the world as themselves, as duke, as priest, as peasant, as pardoner, as prioress, as whatever, living their lives in public. The lord of the manor eats in the hall with his retainers, and there is some indication that anybody who happens to be around can eat, though the place in the hall you get to sit is determined by your social class, and below the salt means you didn't get any.
Judith?
That sense of display is also, I think, a matter of being a member of a status society where rather than defining yourself by your deeds, you are defining yourself partly by your place in a group. And that relates both to the display impulses and also to the lack of privacy, that one feels oneself very much as part of a group. At the end of the Miller's Tale, when John has made a fool of himself and has been declared by his wife and her lover a fool, the entire town understands that he is a fool or crazy. You can't imagine his going on in this village because everyone is a part of the event that has shown him up.
Tess, did you have a comment?
We still have things like the New Yorker ads.
Meaning?
Where display seems to carry on the... What the medievals would have called vainglory, I suspect.
Uh-huh. Standards
many people subscribing to them, whether they can afford it or not. I'd like to shift the question about everyday life a little bit and point out that there's an awful lot of everyday life in the Middle Ages that we simply don't know about. And even when we read, say, Chaucer, and we have a feeling of seeing a tremendous range of medieval life, in fact, what we're seeing is the point of view of not an aristocrat himself, but someone who worked very closely with the aristocracy, a high-level civil servant and diplomat, who really, even when he describes, say, the interior of a peasant's cottage, is still speaking from a point of view that closes out some parts of that experience. And even going on to someone like William Langland, who certainly seems to have more sympathy with the lower classes, you still only get partial glimpses of everyday life. You wish for more. You hear about poor mothers trying to bring up their children in the cold and suffering tremendously, and then that a few lines and it's gone. You have no more information. And even when one looks at the historical and, say, legal documents in which you get a lot of extra information about people suing each other over this, that, and the other thing, you still don't get a full picture. We don't know even such simple things as exactly how fields were plowed.
David?
Well, just to continue what Tess Tavermina was talking about, in Piers Plowman, there was one of the most moving descriptions of the sufferings of the poor and of how difficult it is to be poor, to have many children and not enough food to feed them. Mm-hmm. And so I certainly think in the Middle Ages there is a sense of, there isn't a hard-heartedness about this. There isn't a sense that, well, the poor deserve it. I mean, the poor obviously had a religious sanction in the Middle Ages, and there was a duty, although Langland also suggested this duty was often not carried out, to help the poor and to take care of the poor. But I think to think that somehow they didn't feel it, uh-huh. Now, they obviously didn't have the sort of programs, institutional and governmental things. And usually, I think in the Middle Ages, when it comes to reform, it's the reform of individuals that they often talk about.
I think it's a matter of extended households. The poor tended to belong to somebody who was responsible for them. And if there was enough food to go around, then they all ate. If there wasn't, they all starved together. The lord of the manor might be able to go to London and eat, but the life of the rich, it seems to me, in the Middle Ages, is not as much different from the life of the poor as it is now. They didn't have central heating anywhere. And they were all cold in the wintertime, and they all got wet when it rained.
David.
To carry this on, what always impresses me about the Middle Ages is not that people didn't travel, but that they did travel. Taking a journey. I mean, the number of times you find ecclesiastical officials going from England to Rome, which must have been an extraordinary journey, an incredibly difficult journey, a journey that we just can't, even the Long Island Railroad doesn't begin to compare with that kind of a journey. And yet they did it very regularly.
Judson.
And when the only way to travel was either on horseback or by walking, then the poor had just about as much access to travel as the rich. They simply set off and go.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first in a series of discussions about medieval English literature and society. The panelists for Soundings are four professors of medieval literature and culture, Mary Tavormina, David Benson, Judson Allen, and Judith Furster. Mary Tavormina teaches at Michigan State University, David Benson at the University of Connecticut, Judson Allen at the University of Florida, and Judith Furster at Brandeis University. Mary Tavormina, David Benson, and Judith Furster have all completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where they worked on books about medieval English literature. Here is Mary Tavormina.
Thinking about what Judson Allen was saying about beggars before and travel, one of the problems with the poor was the poor who wandered around and didn't belong to anybody, the vagrant poor. Those people were of much more concern to social commentators than the poor who stayed at home and you kind of knew who they were and you probably knew whether you could trust them or not. You knew what niche they were supposed to be filling, but the wandering poor who had no social obligations in a sense, they weren't tied into the network, were real trouble because they could come and go. And there are laws against, a lot of laws against strangers and taking in strangers without letting the village community know. This is a real concern. And even now you can sense that in small communities, someone who moves in and is a foreigner, for 15 years before they're accepted into the community.
What about criminals in the Middle Ages? Were there lots of criminals, and what kinds of laws existed to meet tests?
Well, crime in the Middle Ages seems to have been extremely high, at least in England. There's a tremendous amount of records of violent crime. Part of the problem is that any death, whether it was what we would call manslaughter or homicide or all our distinctions, it was all considered murder. If you were convicted of having killed someone by accident or whatever, it was a felony and you would be hanged.
Well, I think you find in the Middle Ages often that you don't always have quite the sense of a central government and criminals being people who are for whom the state is after, but the idea of local tyrants getting the law into their own hands, the way perhaps you find in Western movies. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of romances, Middle English romances, where you see the sort of the bad sheriff takes over, just like a grade B Western. And the good people are called outlaws, but they're only outlaws because real law and real justice hasn't come. So there's a kind of sympathy for that kind of outlaw, as you find in literature of the American West.
Judith, tell me about, I guess, what you'd call social order in English society in the Middle Ages. We have a pretty clear sense in the 20th century, at least we seem to, about who belongs in what group and who can move from which group to another. How did all of that work in medieval English society?
There was a very clear theory about orders of society. There were three groups: the knights, the clerics, and the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone belonged to one of them, and they organized the social functions. Knights protected farmers who gave food to the knights. And sometimes when people talked about that in theory, they were very clear about how it was sometimes an exploitative. I'm talking about the aristocracy, which had as its one of its important functions protecting people. Its function was military.
Uh-huh.
And
so it wasn't just soldiers.
No, it was a whole, you'd say it was a whole class. Mm-hmm. The males of whom it was a whole class, the males of whom would be in arms.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about that theory is that in the later Middle Ages, at any rate, it didn't account for everybody. There were new functions. It didn't account for merchants. It didn't account so well for some of the civil bureaucrats. And so it was very hard to give everybody a niche to be clear about where everyone belonged. And Chaucer, in the general prologue to the Canterbury Tales, has some sense that the system isn't working, that some people don't fulfill their functions as they're defined in the theory, and that some people have moved, that there is a kind of upward mobility that isn't accounted for. And he apologizes for not being able to put everybody in this proper order. So there is both the theory that everyone has a niche which they fit into from birth to death, and the fact that there is some possibility of moving because of your own individual efforts.
Judson, Alan.
One interesting confirmation of this is Geoffrey Chaucer's name. Chaucer means shoemaker. And it happens to be true in Chaucer's time that surnames were coming to be surnames instead of trade designations. There were Chaucers who were shoemakers. There's a wonderful list of household retainers in which Nicholas Butler is clearly the guy responsible for the bottles. But not all the names apply, and there is one man named William Hindy, which probably means, as in Hindy Nicholas in the Miller's Tale, graceful will. So some of these names are clearly surnames. Some of these names are clearly trade names. One of these names is clearly a nickname.
So we don't really place enough, not necessarily importance, but We really don't understand what it means to be named Sawyer or Miller or after a place or a trade.
And the medieval desire was that whatever you were, you should be all that and only that in a way that you could function in society in a way so that conflict of interest could never come up. The point I'm making is that medieval people wanted to be complete people. And they wanted their completeness, as whatever they were, to express itself all the time.
And yet, social change continues to happen, and in fact was happening much earlier than Chaucer's time. You find lists of, complex lists of different occupations several centuries earlier, people beginning to realize that it's not just peasants and knights and priests. And society or history forces people to change jobs. Chaucer's at least grandfather, we have to go at least that far back to get a shoemaker because his father was a wine merchant. And you can see the move upwards, it's partly the desire for greater wealth, no doubt, to move from being a shoemaker to a wine merchant to a senior civil servant in the court. So there's a pull of personal advancement going on there, but there's also probably that making shoes is not as much needed, and selling wine, there's a market for wine.
Judith?
These are both controversial points, but I'll say them to get them on the table. On the one hand, you can see this as related to an interest in particulars. We were talking about Aristotle and the concentration on the individual. So that's where it's coming from, perhaps. And where it's going, you might say that where it's going is capitalism, a system in which individual initiative drives the machine. So you want people to believe that they can change themselves and then do things which will also happen to be a benefit to society. What's interesting about the period is that many things are true at the same time.
And they tried, insofar as possible, to erase all distinction between the public and the private. The king's household was the government. Mm-hmm.
David.
And to follow up Judith First's point about the different things going on at the same time, you have spectacular examples in the Middle Ages like Abelard, who when read today seems like so much like a modern neurotic person alienated from his society, who seems to have trouble fitting in various places, and whose own inner turmoil, if you can take the description that's come down to us with any accuracy, does not seems much more modern than the descriptions we get of other people in the Middle Ages.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first segment in a series of discussions about medieval English literature and society. The panelists for Soundings were Judson Allen of the University of Florida, David Benson of the University of Connecticut, Judith Furster of Brandeis University, and Mary Tavormina of Michigan State University. Next week on Soundings, Professors Allen, Benson, Furster, and Tavormina continue their conversation about English literature and society in the Middle Ages. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a discussion about English literature and society in the Middle Ages. Why do modern audiences tend to think of medieval times as the Dark Ages? How do the contract social systems we now inhabit differ from the status societies of the Middle Ages? A panel of scholars from the Universities of Connecticut and Florida, Michigan State University, and Brandeis University has some answers and insights. Medieval Literature and Society, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.